Okay, this is Steve, and this is the lecture on evolutionary biology. So the intention of this lecture is to provide an overview of what evolutionary biology is all about. This is a review. This is not intended to be something that you're going to be held responsible for. So here's our title. So rather than strictly talking about evolutionary biology, really what I'm going to be doing is going into more of what might be called microbial population biology, which is a little bit broader term than mere evolutionary biology. But basically, this is a and that title reflects the title of the chapter this is associated with. But basically, this is going to be a lecture on evolutionary biology. Okay, so what do we have here? So if we're talking about population biology, we're talking about things like evolutionary forces on one hand and ecological interactions on another. Now, the ecology basically sets the stage for where the evolution occurs. You've got an organism. The organism, it has its genetics, it has biochemistry, it has all its molecular aspects that give rise to a phenotype. You have the evolutionary forces that that basically affect the underlying genotype, this is all happening, as I said, within a context of the ecology of the organism. Now, the ecology all is interacting, or almost all, is interacting with the phenotype of the organism. Whereas the evolutionary biology ultimately is interacting with the genotype of the organism. So, what are the evolutionary forces? They are mutation, migration, selection, and drift, which we'll be going through. In terms of ecology, it's all about interactions with other things. These include interactions, if you're a microorganism, with larger organisms, organisms that are in the same species as you, with organisms that are other microorganisms, and then also with chemical and physical abiotic factors. So together, this gives rise to what we can call microbial population biology, which is over here. This considers such things as topic areas as microbiology, microbial ecology, evolutionary ecology, and evolutionary biology. So there's a lot more to all of this than quote unquote just evolutionary biology. So I like to start these lectures by talking about Hardy Weinberg, and you'll see why I'm doing that in a second. So let's start with a standard situation, Hardy Weinberg situation. You've got a diploid population. They interact sexually in order to reproduce. In this case, it's some kind of plant, a flowering plant. We've got alleles associated with a specific locus. So here we've got a big R versus little r allele. We've got diploid individuals. So each individual has two copies of the allele. It's either big R, big R, big R, little r, and little r, little r. Now, obviously, we can increase the complexity of all of this substantially. We can have more than just two alleles. We can have interactions between different loci, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But we're going to ignore all of that for the second, for this, for the moment. So what we've got here is a frequency of, well, actually not a frequency, it's the absolute number of the different genotypes. Down here is the frequency of genotypes. This is the number of individuals. So this is how you calculate frequency of genotypes, which I'm sure you've all had great pleasure in doing, at least in your introductory biology course. And then from these frequencies of genotypes, we can calculate allele frequencies. And it turns out that when we have an allele frequency of 80% or 0.8 for the big R and 20% or 0.2 for the little r, then if you're under Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium, you end up with a specific genotype frequency, which presumably is the frequency that we see up here. In fact, 0.8 times 0.8 is 0.64. So it's very much the frequency that we see up there. So putting in these numbers where they all come from with some arrows. That's our friends P and Q. Remember, the Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium, 1 equals p plus q. Okay, so this is the cross. So we're showing this in a slightly different manner. So we've got dad, which supplied the sperm. We've got mom, which supplied the egg. We have each mom and dad, both of them within the population, 80% of them of the gametes are big R and 20% are little r. We combine these together and we end up with the expected frequency of the resulting genotypes, which is essentially what we just calculated on the previous page. Now you'll see here that what we've done is we've started out with a given generation. I'm going to go backwards. And we've generated gametes. And then we're regenerating the diploid in the next generation, which is what's going on here. And then we can take the frequency of genotypes in the next generation and use that as the basis for determining the frequency of alleles in that generation. And if you're under Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium, the frequency of alleles doesn't change. And in fact, the frequency of genotypes doesn't change either. So what does this mean? It means that evolution is not happening. So gene pool of the next generation. And so this is summing this whole thing up, where you start out with your parental plants, and they're creating, let's see if I can figure out where this is happening. They are creating gametes, and then the gametes are fertilizing each other, and you're coming up with the next generation, and you're keeping track of allele frequencies and genotype frequencies as you go. So the genotype frequencies stay the same. So we started out with 0.64 big A, big A. That's interesting. We seem to have switched from A's to R's, rather from R's to A's. And in the end, somewhere around here, there we are. We are finishing up with 0.64 big A, big A's, and the other numbers are all the same as well. So that means the genotype frequency hasn't changed, and in fact, the allele frequency hasn't changed either. And so we have no changes in what is going on in terms of what alleles and in what fractions they're present in the population. And this is going over time, past to closer to the present. And so what all that means is that no evolution is occurring. So when you have no change in genotype frequencies over time, it means no evolution is occurring. When you have no change in allele frequencies over time, it means no evolution is occurring. So when we have this two allele, one locus system, as we increase the frequency of one allele within the population, the frequency of the other allele in the population declines. I guess it's going that way. And we can graph out the frequencies of these alleles and, the frequencies of the resulting genotypes, and that's shown right here. So in Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium, the genotype frequencies are 100% a function of the previous generation's allele frequencies. So the Hardy-Weinberg equation tells us this. It tells us, starting with the given allele frequencies, what are the genotype frequencies going to be? And if they're not changing, you're under Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium. Now, very importantly, this is the default evolutionary assumption, that you're under Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium, and that means that no evolution is occurring. Right, now for the happy part. I know everybody's just joyous when they see Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium. I know from my youth, that youth meaning when I was in college, that when I first encountered Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium, my first thought was, oh my God, what are we going to do with this? How does this work? This is so crazy. Of course, since then, I've realized that it's really, really, really simple stuff. But nevertheless, it's math. And I guess unless you're totally predisposed towards mathematical thinking, Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium is not going to make perfect sense instantaneously. But now, as I said, the good news. The good news is that most microbes are haploid. They're not diploid. So that kind of simplifies Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium just a little bit. So this means that if you have, for example, a two-allele system, your genotypes will only be, for example, big A and little a. And in the previous example, there were big A, big A, big A, little a, and little a, little a. So that's a lot simpler. Also, phenotypes will generally correspond to either the big A or the little a genotype. So there's no heterozygote. So there's big A, little a. It's not there. In fact, there's big A, and big A, little a are also not there. Now, in terms of the math, this is what the math looks like. So this is the Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium in terms of a two-allele, one-locus system given a diploid organism. Well, for most microorganisms, such as most bacteria, this is what the Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium looks like. 1 equals P plus Q. I'm assuming that everybody who's taking this course can handle that. That's a joke. I mean, it's not a joke that I'm assuming that, but it's nevertheless a joke for me to say that. I mean, clearly that is cinchy stuff. In addition to this, most microorganisms are much less sexual than, for example, animals and plants are. So they don't need to go through a sexual cycle in order to reproduce, and that too greatly simplifies the genetics. Doesn't mean there's no Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium, but it means that things are much simpler than they are in terms of keeping track of the genetics, the population genetics, than they are with, for example, animals and plants. And it also doesn't mean that there is no sex in microorganisms. In fact, a large chunk of this course will be considering sex in microorganisms, but it does mean that in terms of going from generation to generation, we generally don't have to keep track of the combining of alleles when we are, in fact, keeping track of the population genetics. So there are exceptions, as I already mentioned. We have phenotypes that can be influenced by more than one locus. But generally, the population genetics of microorganisms, particularly the ones we're going to be most interested in, are ones of clonal organisms, so not really having sex all that often. They're haploid, so we can get rid of all of this craziness. And they're not diploid. Okay, so Hardy-Weinberg, it tells us it's a situation where there is no evolution going on. And so from there, we can start looking at what kinds of circumstances, what kinds of phenomena can in fact give rise to evolution. Here, evolution being changes in the frequencies of these alleles and genotypes. So first on our list here, although not in a sense the most fundamental in terms of happening first, but first on our list is natural selection. And natural selection is closely allied with what we call Darwinism or Darwinian evolution. There'll be a lot of consideration of that in this course, just because this is where adaptations come from, and evolutionary ecology, which will be an emphasis of this course, is the study of why of adaptations. Why is it that an organism does this one thing versus some other thing? So as I said, although natural selection is fundamental, in a sense, before natural selection can occur, we have to have genetic variation. If we don't have genetic variation, natural selection can't act on anything. And that's because natural selection basically is a differentiation between variation as it occurs. Genetic variation as it occurs among different organisms. There's no genetic variation, there's no way to distinguish among organisms, at least in terms of their genetics. So genetic variation ultimately is associated with mutation. In fact, we can define mutation as being a process that increases the genetic variation of a population. Non-Darwinian mechanisms of evolution, as opposed to Darwinian ones, tend to be not adaptive. So natural selection, adaptive evolution, non-Darwinian mechanisms, in a sense, everything else, non-adaptive. So among the non-Darwinian mechanisms are genetic drift, our mutation, our migration, and non-random mating. This list presumably, it's not quite in alphabetical order, is it? But this list basically is just a list in whatever order it is. I'm not trying to emphasize one thing over another here. So walking through that list, we can start with non-random mating. Non-random mating means that if you take a given egg and given sperm, the likelihood of that egg and sperm getting together is basically the same as that egg getting together with any other sperm or et cetera, et cetera. In terms of microorganisms, it's usually horizontal gene transfer that we're talking about when we're talking about quote-unquote mating. And in this case, non-random mating would be an equal distribution of the genes moving from one organism to another organism. And the truth is that non-random mating, in fact, is not highly likely in microorganisms. So if you're going to be having horizontal gene transfer, almost inevitably, because it's going to be tend to be non-random in its nature, is going to give you some kind of evolution. This non-randomness could be simply because it's much more likely that two bacteria that are near each other, for example, will conjugate versus two bacteria, one on one side of the earth and the other on the other side of the earth. Genetic drift. Genetic drift is just sampling error. If you have infinite populations, you don't have genetic drift. Genetic drift is a stochastic process. It's throwing chance into the mix, especially the post-mutation mix of evolution. This is a representation of genetic drift. When you have a sampling of a population, the smaller that sampling is, the greater the error is going to be. So therefore, the greater the amount of genetic drift. We have this population here. Half of the population is going to be founding a new population. Yeah, there it is, only five of the plants. We're starting out here with a frequency, the big A allele of 0.7 and little a allele of 0.3. It adds up to one. And when we found this new population, we just happen to have picked individuals that have given rise to what ultimately is an allele frequency of 0.5 and 0.5 for the two alleles that are present. And that's a change. That's a change in allele frequency. That's evolution. But it's a random change. We're choosing these five plants randomly. And in fact, we can go and make the sampling even smaller, these two here, and we're founding this population. In fact, we have managed to drive the little a allele extinct. There's only a 1 1/4 chance of doing that, but that's what we've done. So again, that's a change in allele frequency, and that's genetic drift. Genetic drift, in fact, is very good, especially in very small populations, at driving alleles to extinction. But it is a random change. It's a stochastic change. It is a change that happens because of basically not having an infinite sampling of a population. And errors get bigger as the fraction of the sample, or as a fraction of the sample, as the samples get smaller. So there's basically two kinds of genetic drift that people like to talk about. There's genetic bottlenecking, and then there are founder effects. So this is a representation of genetic bottlenecking. This is very fanciful. They've put the beads representing different alleles or different genotypes in a bottle so that you can then pass the beads through a bottleneck. And really, the reason that's important is simply because the bottleneck here is slowing the rate at which the alleles or individuals are going from the parental population to the next generation. If there was no bottleneck there, if it was a cup or a glass, they just pour right in and there'd be no subsampling. But here we have a sampling of only a portion of the population. And that portion of the population can have, because of sampling error, a different allele frequency from the population that is generated. And you can see that, in fact, there are no more yellow or whatever that color is, beads or balls, and therefore the implication, in fact, there's far fewer white ones. The implication is that there has been a change in allele frequency. So we can consider these, in fact, to be haploid individuals. We don't have to consider them to be diploid if we don't want to. So genetic bottlenecking, another representation of this, we basically have a population that goes from being large in size to being smaller in size, and then you have The next generation founded by only a subset of that generation. And what does that mean? It means that we have sampling of the population and therefore the potential for sampling error. The smaller the sampling, the fewer individuals that are involved in initiating the next population, then the greater the potential for stochastic change, random change in the population, going from one generation to another. And when you have substantial random change in the population, you increase the likelihood of both change in allele frequencies and extinction of specific alleles. This is another representation of bottlenecking. Basically, we've taken just a sample of the population. It doesn't have the same frequency, in this case of colors, as the parental population. Note that this is happening in a petri dish. And so, therefore, very applicable to microbiology. Genetic drift, we also have the founder effect. So in the founder effect, the big difference between it and bottlenecking is that when you take the sampling of the parental population, you're moving that sample to a new location. Or alternatively, you're simply cutting off that sample from the parental population. So it's really a spatial removal of one population from another, or a spatial difference between one population and another, rather than a temporal difference between one population and another. Rather than going from parent to offspring, which is what you have with genetic bottlenecking, instead you are going from a parental population to a subpopulation that's no longer connected physically, genetically, to the parental population. Now that new population, because of sampling error, can have a different allele frequency than the parental population. So this is founder effect. Here, rather than taking a sample within a population and keeping those individuals in the same place, we're moving the population from one place to another, from here to here. So note the transfer from one place to another. These guys are founding a new population, hence founder effect. Then there's migration. So migration actually is in multiple ways strange when we're talking about microorganisms. So it's strange, first of all, because the way a population geneticist uses the word migration is different from the way the word migration may be used by an ecologist. So an ecologist talks about a population or even individuals moving from one place to another place. But migration in the case of population genetics or Hardy-Weinberg issues is movement from genes from one population to another population. And in microorganisms, I mean, this can occur because of movement of individuals from one place to another. In fact, in any organism, it can. But because microorganisms tend not to be obligately sexual, the result is that to actually have movement of genes from one population into another population, you have to have horizontal gene transfer. If you just have two clonal populations that have intermixed, they're not really the same population. You really need to get the genes inside another individual. These new genes, if we had an obligately sexual population, they would make their way into the new individual through normal sexual reproductive processes. But with things like bacteria and viruses, it instead often occurs via a process of horizontal gene transfer. And that typically is a small amount of, say, DNA that moves from one individual to another individual and then becomes integrated there. So when we talk about migration in terms of Hardy-Weinberg, it's different from migration in terms of the animals, say, or birds, say, moving from one location to another in the spring and fall. And it's also different from these larger animals in that it's intimately tied up with the idea of horizontal gene transfer with microorganisms. And so what we see here is flow of genes from one population to another. The effect of migration is that it makes the receiving population more similar to the population that's supplying the new genes. So what you have is a, in a sense, an effect that causes populations to become more similar to one another. And this is true even when we are talking about horizontal gene transfer, because with horizontal gene transfer, you have one individual that is suddenly acquiring the genes from another individual. So clearly the recipient is becoming more similar to the individual that's supplying those genes. So the effect of migration, it makes allele frequencies become more similar, and that's in a classical sense. Then there's mutation, and particularly we're talking about net mutation. If you don't have net mutation, then you're not really violating Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium. Net mutation means that you have actually a new mutation occurring that changes the allele frequency. And so here we have simply individuals within the population that are mutating to another form, and the result is a change in the frequency of these colors or alleles. So once you have mutation, you can have genetic variation, and when you have genetic variation, you have polymorphism. So polymorphism means that more than one allele at a given locus is present within a population at a given time. Now, they're actually illustrating this here in terms of differences in morphology. So there's multiple polymorphologies, polymorphisms. But in a population genetic sense, what you care about is simply that there are differences in alleles. So polymorphism means that there are two or more alleles present at a given locus. If you only have one allele present at a given locus within a population, that's a monomorphism. And if you have a monomorphism, you can't have natural selection or any other kind of process, evolutionary process, except for mutation, acting on that locus. But you have polymorphism, suddenly you have two different alleles and you have some potential for change in allele frequency. So these are the non-Darwinian mechanisms, and the Darwinian mechanism is natural selection. So let's move to natural selection. So to understand natural selection, it's important to understand that natural selection acts on phenotypes. But phenotypes are underlain by genotypes. And alleles underlie genotypes, although in the case of most microorganisms, the organism is haploid, which means that in fact the alleles and the genotypes are the same thing. If you have a big A allele, then you're going to have a big A genotype at a given locus. So natural selection ultimately acts on allele frequencies, but that selection occurs through a filter of both phenotype and genotype. Again, the genotype filter is less important in microorganisms, in the sense that there's only one allele making up the genotype. On the other hand, with non-obligately sexual organisms, you've got the problem that the entire organism, the entire genome, basically represents the genotype. And as a consequence, you have strong amounts of linkage going on between the different alleles. And when natural selection acts on a given allele, it's doing so within the context of a genotype that otherwise is relatively constant, even going from generation to generation. So you have the skewing of how natural selection can act by the fact that it's acting on phenotype, and then you've got, in microorganisms, a genotype that is relatively unfixed, because gene transfer doesn't happen all that often. So nonetheless, everything at least arguably is simpler with haploid organisms, but nonetheless, sorry to repeat that word, we have the overlaying of a complication in that we have organisms that, although they're haploid, they tend not to be obligately sexual. This is just an example of a microorganism. It is a bacteriophage. It's actually bacteriophage lambda, which is haploid. So every gene in here, every locus in here has exactly one allele present at it. There's actually some, these are bacteriophages, viruses of bacteria. There's some wiggle room in that, because phages often have what are known as circularly permuted chromosomes. And so at a low level, on some occasions, it is possible to have more than one allele, but we're not going to worry about details like that. But more importantly, I was at a meeting almost 10 years ago, and there were two students who worked with phage lambda who basically tattooed, as a consequence, lambda on their shoulders, and we called them the lambda twins. I've been showing this slide for a while now. So, Darwinism, Darwinian evolution. So natural selection is the differential reproductive success within populations. It's an unequal ability of individuals to survive and reproduce, and specifically an unequal ability that's a consequence of phenotype and underlying genotype. Know that there's an emphasis on reproduction rather than survival. Survival is important because if you don't survive, you can't reproduce, or if you don't survive sufficiently long, you can't reproduce. However, key to understanding what Darwinian evolution is all about is the concept of reproductive success. It's really how many babies you make that's important. You can survive all you want. If you don't make babies, you're toast. Natural selection occurs through an interaction between the environment and the genetic variability that's seen within populations. So some genotypes are going to be more fit within population, within a given environment rather, than others within the same population. And natural selection will tend to increase the frequency of these more fit genotypes, these genotypes that are better able to interact with the environment and reproduce there. The result of that will be differential success, will be a change in allele frequencies that reflects the better ability of some genotypes to reproduce over another. It's important, though, to keep in mind that what genotypes are more fit is going to vary depending upon the characteristics of the environment. The product of natural selection is adaptation of populations of organisms to their environment. As natural selection goes on, the organisms either become or remain, either become better adapted to their environments, better able to survive and reproduce, or remain at some optimal level of reproductive ability and survival ability within an environment. So natural selection gives rise to adaptations. Adaptations and natural selection go hand in hand. It's only by chance that you'll end up with an adaptation that's a consequence from non-Darwinian mechanisms. Natural selection, on the other hand, what it does is it produces adaptations. Differential reproductive success results in differences in clutch sizes, differences in number of clutches per lifetime, differences in generation times, and differences in the likelihood of survival up to and throughout an organism's reproductive life. And this is just a fanciful illustration of what natural selection is all about. Clearly, this wolf is after this fox. Well, that's actually odd now that I think about it with an eraser. The fox gets erased, maybe as a consequence of differences in its genotype between some other fox and, well, anyway, that's what that's all about. So a summation of Darwinism. So underlying Darwinism, you have genotype, you have changes in genotype, they're called mutations. Changes in genotype can give rise to changes in phenotype. They don't necessarily do, but they can. Changes in genotype can be seen as variability in populations. And this basically is differences in the adaptations that these organisms display. Adaptations being a measure or a phenomena that allows an organism to interact with its environment in some manner. It contributes to survival and reproductive success. Now, you can start having selective pressures acting on this variability, that is, the environment is causing a greater or lesser reproductive success by some genotypes versus other, and the result is natural selection, which is a change in allele frequencies within the population. Now, in the case of this change, natural selection will increase the frequency of those alleles that are more fit to the population. More generally, a change in allele frequency within the population is simply evolution itself, and it's not necessarily adaptive. But in the case of natural selection, that is adaptation. And then going onward, if you have enough of this going on, you can end up with, in association with other phenomena, the formation of new species. All together, this is evolution. Species go extinct, alleles go extinct. But basically, this is what we're talking about here. Mutation gives rise to changes in genotype, phenotype. There's variability in the population. Natural selection can act on that variability, give you changes in allele frequencies, which is adaptive evolution in this case, because natural selection is involved. So another fun little cartoon, so natural selection at work. But actually, this is not true. It's only true because clearly they have eliminated one of the possible victims from their little scheme here. But in fact, it's only natural selection if they've eliminated that victim based upon differences in its genotype versus another individual. Although it's fun to say it's natural selection at work, we actually don't know if it's natural selection at work. It could be that they just decided, for reasons that have nothing to do with the genotype of that individual, it might just be farther away to go for that individual or that individual, or however they're working this out. It must also be emphasized that the specifics of natural selection are situational. Environmental factors vary from place to place and from time to time, and adaptation in one situation may be useful or even detrimental in different circumstances. I don't recall exactly where this come from. I'm a terrible scholar. I hang my head low. But it probably came from the Campbell introductory biology text. Ecology is also relevant to population biology. Evolution occurs within an ecological context. It simply does, and it provides all sorts of complications on how things occur. So this is an overview of what ecology is all about. It's particularly in terms of community ecology and ecosystem ecology. Community ecology is interactions between different species. Population ecology is an interaction between conspecifics, so the study of it. Ecosystem ecology is the following, particularly of nutrients and energy through ecosystems. So here we have energy, such as photons giving rise to photosynthesis. We also have nutrients, such as maybe picked up in the soil. And together, the producers take these things and convert those substrates into new producer biomass, which is subsequently consumed by consumers, perhaps. And consumers, for example, animals, can be consumed by other consumers, such as other animals, which can be consumed by other consumers, such as other animals. But ultimately, things die and they decompose. And in fact, in the course of all this consumption, at a minimum, feces are removed from these organisms or lost from these organisms, partially digested food. And this also frees up nutrients, soil bacteria free up nutrients, and these nutrients are available for producers again, and so on and so forth. The circle of life, as it were. And then we can kind of integrate all sorts of things into with regard to evolutionary biology, which I've done in this this figure here. So we have nucleotide sequence, which is genotype. And then nucleotide sequence is acted upon. It provides the code that gives rise to the biochemistry of an organism, goes through transcription and translation. That biochemistry in combination with developmental biology, which really is just biochemistry, gives rise to a whole organism, and whole organisms make up populations. Populations can interact with other populations, other species. That's community ecology. Populations can interact with themselves. That's population ecology. Populations can interact with abiotic components of their environments. That's ecosystem ecology. As our abiotic components. You have the potential for populations to vary over time as a consequence of natural selection, as well as drift while all of this other stuff is going on, all this ecology is going on. You have this variation being modified via ongoing mutation, migration, and also gene exchange between individuals. This modifies what nucleotide sequences are available in a population and in what frequency they're available in the population. And before I go on to this soft selection thing, let me throw out there this, that I probably should be drawing a lot more arrows towards natural selection here than I actually do. But going back to soft selection is basically selection that happens within populations. It's different individuals within populations that are vying for dominance within a given population. So now soft selection is a kind of selection that doesn't give rise to an increase in the fitness of the overall population. It's just based upon differences in fitness within the population as these individuals compete against each other, so, for example, for mates. And this contrasts with hard selection, in fact, when a population responds to hard selection, the result is a change in the fitness of that population within the environment that that population is found. And this is really important. Soft selection is important too, but hard selection is really important. This is what is happening when you take a population, you put that population in a new environment, and the population adapts to that new environment. In the course of that adaptation, the fitness of the population as a whole increases. And so, for example, if you take bacteria and you put those bacteria in an environment that contains an antibiotic, this is an going from an environment lacking an antibiotic to one that has an antibiotic, the antibiotic could supply a selective force acting against these bacteria. The bacterial population might crash as a consequence, but some of those individuals in the population may be inherently resistant to the antibiotic, and they will, in a sense, found a new population. In the course of all of this, we have a change in allele frequency. The frequency of the antibiotic resistance gene starts from being low and ends up being high. And it's hard selection in that it's a process that reduces the fitness of the population of a whole as this new novel selective force becomes present in their population. In fact, could drive the population to extinction. And the population responds by evolving, but in the course of evolving, it increases its fitness, average fitness within the population in this new environment. The fitness in the old environment, I mean, if you transplanted the population back again, might not be any different. In fact, it might even be lower. But importantly, in the new environment, you have an increase in fitness in response to, as an evolutionary response to hard selection. And that's it for today's lecture, or at least the lecture on population biology. There's a lot more to population biology, and when we get to the chapter considering the evolution of resistance, we'll have a lot of review of concepts of evolutionary biology, particularly as relevant to microorganisms.